Committee on Water Environment, Tuesday, June 22nd, 1999, 8:15 a.m., Hearing Room C.
House Committee on Water Environment will come to order. And we have on our agenda today, House Bill 3633. And I will open a hearing on House Bill 3633. And we'll invite the Speaker of the House, Ms. Andre.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
I appreciate the opportunity and I appreciate the fact that you're all here this morning as a tribute to you, especially after the fun party that we had last night. Thank you for coming and attending. Also, for the record, my name is Rose Sawgrass. I am a state representative from District 10, and you have before you House Bill 3633. 3633 is a culmination of work from all special work meetings, a lot of listening to committees, to the Ways and Means, and to the Education Policy Committee throughout the building and the House and the Senate. My prepared remarks I'm going to give you right now, and then I will be here for as long as you want to answer any questions that you might have. Chair, it's my understanding that this bill will not be heard out today. I would appreciate the opportunity to hear from people after they've heard the testimony and to include their comments, but I would encourage that, and hopefully you would not do a work session until later this week so that we can accommodate other people's feelings about the bill and make sure that the bill does go out and has strong support throughout the building. This legislative session has reminded me more than I expected that I'm a teacher first and foremost. My responsibility to our children has taken many phases, and today I'm putting all of those components together, all of the frustrations, all of the ideas, all of the concerns, and all of the desires for achievement, put them together in this bill. Our teachers, our parents, and our children yearn for a team effort, a comprehensive approach to our educational system. When I say educational system, I'm not talking about K-12. I'm talking about K-16. That's our educational system here. They want, and quite frankly, they deserve, our leaders and our education partners to have the same vision, to move in the same direction with the same goals in mind. No territory, kids in mind. We have not provided for that in the past. My vision of our education system is one of success. I want to focus on the positive. I want to focus on the success. And today is the first day of Project Success. I'm told by many people that this is monumental. This is a monumental approach. Project Success will put the decision makers of the state at the table at the same time to finally define in the most understandable terms what taxpayers, what moms, what dads, what students, administrators, lawmakers like yourselves, all of us have a right to expect from our education system. At the table will be the governor, the superintendent of public instruction, the president of the Senate, the speaker of the House, the commissioner of Boley, the chancellor of higher ed, the commissioner of the community college, along with 14 other Oregonians, who will finally define accountability in education. They will identify the roles and clarify the responsibilities of all those involved in the public education of our children. We will be establishing goals so that the high standards that we have already set in place and already expect so that they can be achieved. The timing of this bill is intentional. We will be leading session shortly, and the leaders of the state can sit down without the distraction of session to determine what is best for our students, whether they're in the third grade or finishing college. What do we want them to achieve? What issues impact them the most? How can we link K through 16 together so that success is the end result? We have an era of finance, of school finance, that has changed. If we don't look at outcomes, our budget decisions are not complete. We need a system review, a forum to determine our priorities. We need to agree on a direction that we want to take education, and everyone needs to focus their energy on getting it done. Linking Oregon's K-16 system, assigning responsibilities to achieve goals, assessing the progress in reaching those goals, and then involving parents and teachers at every step of the process. This plan, as you read in the bill, is aggressive. It's get the work done in a school year. We expect our students to go from point A to point B and to accomplish a school year and to be able to move on. I think we can expect the same from our legislative leaders, the leaders of our state. My vision for Oregon's education future is through the eyes of a mother, through the eyes of a teacher, and as a legislative leader. And Oregon deserves nothing less than the opportunity for success. And what I'd like to do now is to just quickly go over some of the highlights and the key points of House Bill 3633. First of all, I want to bring to your attention what the objective is. Regardless of what the rhetoric has said in the building, let me tell you what the objective is. It's establishing goals so that the high standards that we have set can be achieved. When I say goal, I mean a goal, K-16. How can higher education and K-12 sit down at the same table and achieve the same goals? How can that happen? We need to establish those goals together. It's linking Oregon's K-16 education system, creating accountability measurements. And when I say the word accountability, each one of you comes up with a different idea of what accountability is. Some of you think of measurements and achieving certain grades on a test. Some of you think of certain pay scale for a teacher. Some of you feel that it's a certain number of kids in a classroom. What we need to do, and one of the main criteria for this particular panel, is to establish and to define what accountability is. And accountability may be different issue by issue. But what does it mean? It means fiscal, obviously. It means administrative, obviously. But there are other things that we need to be accountable for and that we need to hold our children accountable to. So it creates accountability measurements. It defines the roles of all the educational leadership. It assigns responsibilities to achieve those goals, and then it assesses progress to reaching those goals. Project Success has team members, and they're specifically at the table for a reason. The governor will be at the table. He will appoint three members. The superintendent of public instruction will be at the table. In fact, he's the chair of this Project Success. According to the bill, he has two appointments. One of them will be the superintendent of Portland Public Schools. The president of the Senate and the speaker of the House have three appointments. One each will be a legislator. Again, so that there is buy-in. And the other two could be teachers, they could be parents, the list goes on. The Bureau, the commissioner, the Bureau of Labor and Industries will be at the table. We need to make sure that labor and industry are at the table. He has an appointment in addition to himself. The commissioner from the community college will be at the table to make sure that that educational entity is represented. The chancellor of higher education will be at the table. So you have seven members that will do the appointing of a total of 14. And the bill calls for for the representation to come from parents, from teachers, from school board members, school administrators, private college presidents, administrators, so that all of the entities that have a reason to believe and to want to be at the table are represented. I want to make sure that parents are at the table, and parents are PTA members. I want to make sure the teachers are at the table. I want to make sure the school board members are at the table. Through conversations, we can make sure that all of those entities are at the table at the same time. Project Success has goals, and I've listed in section 3, a list to choose from, and it's meant to brainstorm the kinds of things that we should deal with and set as priorities, but it's not the only list. This team and you yourself can make suggestions to this team. What are some of the areas of interest? What are some of the areas that we can look to and prioritize and make recommendations about in order to have the seamless K-16 the system accomplish. And I've just listed here some of the areas that are listed in the bill. Reading and math, are they a priority? Are they the highest priority? Project success can make that determination and then make recommendations to a variety of entities of how to accomplish making that the number one priority. Class size, parental involvement, autism, safe school environment, defining accountability, national teacher licenses. These are some of the issues as I've listened to teachers and as I've listened to parents. These are some of the areas that continue to come up. All of these are important, but the leadership team can set them into a priority, set them in lists of priorities, and make recommendations to the governmental entities so that we're all talking about the same thing all across the state at the same time. Test scores, teacher training, instructional costs. These were not put in any particular order. There are just a list of items that we should include but are not limited to. The success timeline is aggressive. It's done within a school year. You give a team 3 years, they're going to take 3 years to do the work. You give them a school year, you give them 9 months, and they'll complete the work. The timeline is set up this way. The appointments will be completed by September, and then we'll start meeting twice a month as a team. The subcommittees, as the chair of the organization, chair of the team decides, can meet however often he determines. But we'll meet twice a month with the goal of making preliminary recommendations in February, and then adopting the recommendations in March, and making the recommended policies and rules to the state agencies in April. To give plenty of time for buy-in, plenty of time for conversation, and keeping it away from the summertime and the lingering of committee work. The bill has had lots of input, and it's been interesting to me over the last 4 days the kinds of questions that have come up and the concerns that and suggestions that have been made. And again, Chair, I want to compliment you on not wanting and not putting this through on a work session today, because I too want to include whatever will make this successful. That's the goal of project success, is to have it be completed and have everybody sit at the table. I have watched many task forces in the 4 years that I've been here. In fact, I've participated on several of them. And the most successful ones are the ones that have the most buy-in. It would be very difficult to, as a legislative body, and we've noticed that if you've been on committees yourself that have come up with ideas, and because whatever the entity is that you wanted to make the recommendation to, because they weren't at the table helping you make that decision, it was much more difficult to get that energy going in that direction. It's like a fish going upstream, if you will. That is why the people are at the table the way that they are. I don't want labor to be left out. I don't want the community colleges to be left out. I want parents and teachers to be left out. I believe that the process will accommodate that. One of the key questions that's been asked has to do with the state board, and I appreciate the questions that have come forward. The main question was, does this circumvent the state board's authority? Let me tell you emphatically, it absolutely does not. It absolutely does not. If I thought that this should be a super board, I would have put it in the bill that this committee would go on in perpetuity. But it's not what the leadership team's goal is. That is not how they will be successful. The team is set up to make recommendations, to make suggestions to governmental entities, and one of them obviously will be the state board. But the state board will hear from, in fact, maybe a member of the state board will be appointed to the leadership team. There's nothing in the bill that prohibits that. But the state board will hear from the leadership team what their recommendations are from K-16, not just K-12. And likewise for the state board of higher education. Another question that has been raised, is this a local control issue? Are we taking away from local control? And I believe that this will help instill back local control. One of the complaints that we've heard all session is that the legislature is taking away local control. This legislative leadership team, excuse me, this education leadership team can determine if that's in fact happening. And how can we either minimize that, or what are some of the guidelines in order for that not to happen? State goals and state vision help local control. They don't hurt local control. And if the state vision by the leadership team is that, for instance, reading is the number one priority, how can that take away from local control? It can only enhance some of the things that they're trying to do on a local level. Chairman Welsh, I'm going to pause at this point and answer any questions that you might have. I've noticed that some people have been jotting down some notes. Perhaps they have some questions that I'm more than prepared to answer at this point.
Thank you, Speaker Sandra. Questions from the committee? President Cruz. Thank you.
Chair, I've got 10 minutes. Maybe I'll start with a quick couple. I'm speaking with how do you see this fitting in with the community you've already created?
With the review committee and with the finance committee, again, it's enhancement. They both are set up for specific reasons. One is for funding, and the bill directly states that this is not about funding. This is about quality. This is about the end product. Regardless of what the funding process is or how much money, we still need to focus on what the outcome is, and the outcome is about quality. The outcome is about accountability. So to focus on that. The Finance Committee has a charge in front of them, and they will do that, and they can make recommendations to the Education Leadership Team, but in and of itself, they will do their work. The Review Committee, the review of the Education Quality Model, that has a goal in and of itself, and that's to bring teacher input and review to what that quality model panel is doing. They will complete their work, and they can make recommendations to the education leadership team. With or without the education team, those two committees will go forward. They will complete their work and can make recommendations to the next legislative session, as can this team. They actually will enhance each other, but they're not in conflict at all with each other. Each stands on its own.
One more question. One of the frustrations I had during the session on the Human Resources Committee and trying to deal with juvenile issues was a disconnect between the education component at state and community level and all the other services that were used. So, and try to find ways to have a connection here, and I haven't noticed specifically in here where that sort of issue is addressed, nor do I see any of those players on your group, and I'm wondering if we are just looking just at the school itself or the ancillary impact on the school that happens to all these other things that go on in.
Chair Welsh, Representative Cruz, you brought up actually several very good issues. One is the disconnect, and that has been one of my frustrations. That's why you see so many people at the table, because there is a disconnect. And I have to tell you, the community colleges are doing a fabulous job. Higher education is doing a fabulous job. K-12 is doing a fabulous job, but we need to bridge those together in one entity. There's a lot of work that's being done in one area that is being duplicated in another area. What this leadership team can do is to bridge all of those together and to come up with a unified front. If you'll notice on page 2 of the bill, section 2, subsection 6, this could very well take care of what you're talking about. The chairman, and that would be the superintendent of public instruction, according to the way the bill is written, has at his at his control the authority to assign subcommittees. And the subcommittee, one subcommittee could deal with human resource issues and bring those issues to the table in a consolidated, and I'm brainstorming here, but bring those issues to the table. And they could have on that subcommittee, the bill calls for at least 7 members of the team, again, for that buy-in. So there's that continued buy-in of what's going on. But then that subcommittee could deal with whatever that particular issue is, and if it's health-related issues, then they could deal with the health-related issues. And could bring to the subcommittee whatever membership says, line 43, the chairman can determine the representation, the membership, the chairmanship of that, the organization of each of this committee, etc. So they can be at the table discussing those issues and helping the team then prioritize whether that's a number one issue or number two or number three. What's the number 10? What are some of the recommendations that can be made? But this team was set up on a 9-month plan on purpose. The project is bigger than 9 months. It truly is bigger than 9 months. But the energy that got forth in this is invaluable. It can make recommendations to the next legislative session. It can make recommendations to rulemaking. It can make recommendations to the state board. Can make recommendations to the emergency board if there's funds allocated to the emergency board. Make recommendations in place, but the point is that there has to be buy-in in order for those recommendations to go any further than that.
I'm excited about this from the perspective, number one, that I've been an advocate for education, extensive for a long time. I think the only way we can do education is another way. Testimony in one of my committee hearings on people from UA University on the School for the 21st Century model, which is designed to teach an integration basically at the local level we have been in the last few years shifting more and more of our problems to school and that we take care of them. Which is absolutely the wrong way to go. And we have put a huge burden on that system that they didn't have for and for we shouldn't have. So I think we, unless we look outside of the borders, we are still going to be left with a lot of the same things to deal with. And so I just want to have this on the record so that to make sure that we are looking beyond the walls of the school building and looking at the models.
I appreciate that comment, Representative Cruz. Again, I'd like to give you a hypothetical of how the K-16 might work. When I talk about K-16, I often think about those students that are in a classroom that want to be teachers. And they are there because they want to eventually get into the third grade classroom or an eighth grade classroom. And they are there learning what they can about how to teach. Well, let me give you a couple of scenarios. We have many classrooms in college that are being taught by professors that have never been in a classroom teaching, for instance, third grade reading, but they're teaching these future teachers about third grade reading. Now, that may or may not be a problem. I don't know. Obviously, it's the quality of professors. But if we have reading as the number one priority, perhaps one of the energies, one of the recommendations we can make is to get some of those professors into a third grade classroom for a short period of time to put in practice what they've been telling these future teachers actually work. There's another issue, parental involvement. It's an intangible. How can we measure parental involvement? By how many parents are actually in the hallways, perhaps? What does parental involvement have to do with college? I mean, you can't get parents in college. Well, let me give you another suggestion. If we say that parental involvement is one of the most key components of education in order to provide success, and perhaps we can focus on how higher education can help with that. Maybe more classes in community relations, community involvement. Very simple, minor changes, but the point is, if we as a leadership team have decided that parental involvement will make the biggest input, the biggest movement in success for our kids, then how can we offer, what can we offer K through 16 in order to accomplish that? It's not a third grade problem, not a high school problem. If it's an education, if it's something that's getting in the way of us being successful and of our children being successful, then how can we sit down at the table and talk about that and come up with some successful, seamless decisions?
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a script for my questions, but I have a lot of questions that I've thought up on my own. And one is, I'm concerned, first of all, that we as a legislative assembly appear not to have fulfilled our responsibility by not taking this up early in the session, assigning it to the proper committee, and allowing hearing rooms full of parents and teachers and students to come, which I think we've been anxious to do, to talk about education in our state. I'm concerned that in the interim task force set up that we'll have maybe a teacher there, maybe a parent there, but I don't think that one parent can speak for all parents and one teacher can speak for all teachers. So I value the hearings process, and I see that being circumvented in this, and I wonder if you might just address that.
Absolutely. First of all, I will be there. If the bill passes and if I'm still speaker at that time, I will be there. I'm there as a parent, I'm there as a teacher, I'm there as a leader. So there will be representation. In fact, all of the members that are coming forward, we at any point in time, they can have a different hat on. That's number one issue. Number two, nothing is being circumvented. In fact, these will be open hearings. More people will be able, in fact, this could be an opportunity for parents to have the ears of all the leaders at the same time and to hear from all the leaders at the same time what they're thinking. I think that that's an advantage, not a disadvantage. But the other piece of this, and Representative Taylor, and perhaps it's not as clear in the bill as it could be, and if you have some suggestions of how to make it more clear, I'd be happy to listen to those recommendations. We will be making, as a leadership team, recommendations to the next legislative session, for instance. There's a variety of places we can make those recommendations. The legislature then will go through the hearings process. The parents will have, or the teachers, administrators, they will have an opportunity then to address some of the recommendations that this leadership team has brought forward. So in a sense, they're getting more of an opportunity than less of an opportunity.
Another question, if I may, Mr. Chair. My question is, I don't see the superintendent of education here, but is not that superintendent already doing the liaison work between the Board of Higher Ed and the State Board of Education and the seamless approach that we hope will be the result of this group?
Chair Welsh, Representative Taylor, the superintendent of public instruction in years past and in years future, including this one, does have that ability to do that, absolutely. But I'm not sure that the superintendent of any, in fact, I've been told that this has never been done before, where we've actually sit down all of the leaders of the state to talk about something as critical as education. And because this person, the chair of this committee, is also the superintendent of public instruction, we've actually given him more direction, more ability, more authority to say to the state board or to the State Board of Higher Education or to the legislature, this is what the leaders have said. The leaders of the state have recommended as the number one priority. Now, how can we make this work? How can each one of the entities that he takes this information to, how can we make this work? Now, because I've asked him in the bill, I've directed this, the superintendent of public instruction to be the chair of it. That's the most logical place. That's the most logical person. I could have done this, quite honestly, I could have done this very different. I could have said, I could have not brought a bill forward. I could have said, this is going to be something that Lois Dargis is going to do in the interim as Speaker of the House. What kind of buy-in would that have had in later days? I would have had them to make sure that I had buy-in from the state board, buy-in from the superintendent, buy-in from here, buy-in there. My goal was not for it to be about the speaker, not for it to be about land, not for it to be about the House of Representatives, quite honestly, or the legislature, quite honestly. This bill is about our kids. This bill is about all of the decision makers of the state being at the table at the same time, talking out of the same side of the mouth about our children.
Just one more comment. We all come here from where we've been, and I was here in the 91 session when the Education Act for the 21st Century passed. The former speaker was the author of that act, and we had a process where all the legislature as well as other interested parties were involved in passing that by a
recommendations. We will be making, as a leadership team, recommendations to the next legislative session, for instance. There's a variety of places we can make those recommendations. The legislature then will go through the hearings process. The parents will have, or the teachers, administrators, they will have an opportunity then to address some of the recommendations that the leadership team has brought forward. So in a sense, they're getting more of an opportunity than less of an opportunity.
My question is, I don't see the superintendent of education here, but is not that superintendent already doing the liaison work between the Board of Higher Ed and the State Board of Education and the seamless approach that we hope will be the result of this group?
Chair Welsh, Representative Taylor, the superintendent of public instruction in years past and in years future, including this one, does have that ability to do that, absolutely. But I'm not sure that the superintendent of any, in fact, I've been told that this has never been done before, where we've actually sit down all of the leaders of the state to talk about something as critical as education. And because this person, the chair of this committee, is also the superintendent of public instruction, we've actually given him more direction, more ability, more authority to say to the state board or to the state board of higher education or to the legislature. This is what the leaders have said. The leaders of the state have recommended as the number one priority. Now, how can we make this work? How can each one of the entities that he takes this information to, how can we make this work? Now, because I've asked him in the bill, I've directed the superintendent of public instruction to be the chair of it. That's the most logical place. That's the most logical person. I could have done this, quite honestly, I could have done this very different. I could have said, I could have not brought a bill forward. I could have said, this is going to be something that Lynn Stogus is going to do in the interim as Speaker of the House. What kind of buy-in would that have had in later days? I would have had them to make sure that I had buy-in from the state board, buy-in from the superintendent, buy-in there. My goal was not for it to be about the speaker, not for it to be about Lynn, not for it to be about the House of Representatives, quite honestly, or the legislature, quite honestly. This bill is about our kids. This bill is about all of the decision makers at the state being at the table at the same time, talking out of the same side of the mouth about our children.
Just one more comment. I guess we all come here from where we've been, and I was here in the 91 session when the Education Act of the 21st Century passed. The former speaker was the author of that act, and we had a process where all the legislature as well as other interested parties were involved in passing that in a bipartisan way. I just can't help but recommend that process over the many interim committees that we have established during this legislative session. I think we've taken a bashing of the legislature for our lack of attention to education needs. I wish I felt that this was the answer to that, but instead I'm feeling that we've done a lot of referrals, we've established a lot of task forces, we've passed a lot of measures that are going to be vetoed, and we're all going to be tarred with that same brush, that this has been that kind of legislative session. I don't see this getting us where we need to go. And I have concerns about education, and I want to make sure we have a really good participatory system. When we talk about the leaders of the state will have come together, I'm more concerned that we fill the Capitol with parents and teachers and students themselves, and not have a top-down kind of thing. It seems to me we have benchmarks relating to education. We have newly established excellent standards. And we have, in my communities, in my district, in the school districts, site teams that are working to meet those standards. And I'm really proud of your efforts. I am concerned about overlaying that with another layer of recommendations or goals or whatever. I've been a state employee and, you know, spent a lot of my, so much time making goals and objectives that I wasn't really having time to do the important work that I thought I was there for. So how do we get around those criticisms, I guess, my question.
First of all, we never get around criticism, no matter what we do. We're not going to get around criticism. But if we don't have the leaders of the state at this table together, then we have less vision, less opportunity for vision. I'm not suggesting in this bill that what this leadership team comes up with should circumvent the legislative process or circumvent the site council process. None of that is written in this bill. It's to make recommendations. None of the words in this bill say that we should not go forward with education reform or stop any of the standards. This is a process in order for us to help focus on what is the most important, and we're already going forward in the same direction. And I'll use reading again as a component. component. We have standards in reading. We have benchmarks in reading. We have high standards in reading. I don't think there's anybody in the state that doesn't think reading is not important. But we haven't sat down and said collectively, okay, we're going to use all of our energy right now for the next 2 years talking about reading. And what are the components? What is something that everybody can do in order to focus on that? What can the governor do to focus on that? What can the Commissioner of Labor and Industries do to focus on that? How can the legislature focus on that? How can community colleges? How can we have the end product be better than what it is right now? If we determine that reading is the number one priority for the state, perhaps the number one priority in the state is a class size. Now, how can each one of those components come together? We're not suggesting that any of those, that anything that the local site councils are doing should stop from what's happening. It should stop at this point in time from completing their work. But if the leaders of the state get together and say, this is what we think should happen, now legislature, come up with your recommendations. That's what the leadership team will do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why are we waiting so late in the legislative session to start this bill rolling through the process?
Representative Morgan, thank you. Thank you for that question. Actually, this could have been dealt with last session of the session before. But I kept thinking, okay, we're going to be accountable. We're going to hold our kids accountable. We're going to hold the teachers accountable. It will just naturally happen. Accountability will just naturally happen. Education reform is at the point now where things should just naturally happen. It's not naturally happening. I've been scratching my head, to be perfectly honest. Why isn't this naturally happening? It's because we've never had to sit down together and make a decision, have a unified direction, a unified decision. That's one element. The other element is that I didn't want it to be distracting. And I want to talk about education funds. We've been talking about it all session. I didn't want this to be to take away from the fact that we need to talk about funding. This is on purpose. I wanted this to start at the end of session and go into the interim and rather be the focus of the session. And I also wanted to listen as long as I could to all of the hearings, to the work that was going on in the House Committee and in the Senate Committees and the Ways and Means process, and to have those parents and those teachers come forward. And quite honestly, we have a new superintendent of public instruction, and I wanted him to have the ability to come in and start his work and get his direction before we got another scenario to him. And that's what this bill does, is to give him another opportunity to be a leader in education.
Mr. Chairman, I have a follow-up.
Hello. Yes.
The representative from Powell Butte has been working on a quality education model. Can you discuss how you see these two things meshing together?
The way that they meshed, Chair Welsh and Representative Morgan, the way that I see them meshed together, and so I just received the final report, by the way, on Monday and haven't had a chance to totally read the final report, but I read the mission that they have, and the mission that they had was to deal with funding. This bill specifically says this is not about funding, this is about the outcome. Regardless of what a model school will look like, we still need to determine how we can go forward in a unified way to accomplish our goals. Regardless of what the class size is, regardless of what the model school looks like, regardless of how much money you put into a school building or the way that you fund school buildings, and that's what the quality model does right now, is that it funds schools a certain way. Under certain guidelines. They don't talk about energy K through 16. They don't talk about decisions of what the end product is. They talk about what the internal workings should look like. But they don't set the priorities in place. They have what it looks like. This is what a school should look like with these components. And if it looks this way, then you should get this outcome. But it doesn't say that reading would be the number one priority, or that class size should be the number one priority, or that that parental involvement should be the number one priority, or that distance learning should be in every school building. It doesn't bring those kinds of issues. But what I'm saying is that these are not competing entities at all. That model has a purpose. It's a good purpose, and we should not throw out the work of that model.
This also has a purpose. K-16 with decision makers at the table, it's not, I can't see how it can be arguable that this is not important and necessary.
Mr. Chairman, one more.
Yes, one more.
The, on the makeup of the team, the I'm curious as to why the superintendent of the Portland Public Schools was chosen to be appointed, and my concern rests in the fact that one of the great strengths and one of the great challenges of the state is the huge diversity that's brought on by the urban-rural split and the economic differences in the state. And when I read the makeup of the board, one of the things that occurred to me and concerned me was that the small rural schools weren't represented in this, and there was no attempt to even out geographically representations in the state. And so I would be very interested in seeing a component like that added to it.
Thank you for that suggestion. The purpose, Chair Wilson, Representative Morgan, the purpose of adding the Portland Public School Superintendent to the bill specifically was because it is the largest school district in the state, and I felt that that person should have a place at the table representing other large school districts in the state. Your point about rural schools can be addressed in a variety of ways. One, it could be amendment to the bill that a superintendent from a rural school be included. But it also could be addressed in Section 2, Subsection 6 again, in the subcommittee role. And that is a place, there is so much flexibility in that component alone of who can be a member, who can have some say in that aspect. In fact, what Subsection 6 could do is it could have the PTA chairman of Oregon at the table. It could have the COSA chairman at the table and the OSBA chairman at the table. It could have all those components. It could have, and in the school board association or the superintendent's association, they could make sure that the rural school superintendent, whether that person, if there's one person that's in charge of just the rural, that person comes forward. You know, there's class size or school size differentials to make sure that the small schools, the medium schools, and large schools are all at the table. As one of the subcommittees and one of the components to their input, and then those seven leadership team members, at least seven, it could be more than that, but at least those seven can hear from those, from that representation around the issues, whatever the issues are that are brought forth to them, and then take them back to the leadership board. I welcome an amendment if you would prefer, but I try to give as much flexibility as I could in subsection 2 for those kinds of components to be brought forward. And some of that will depend on what the leadership team determines to be the priority. If the leadership team determines that the priority is then those subcommittees would take a different look, would take a different flavor than if it was national teacher licensure as the number one priority. So again, I've tried to give some flexibility to the chairman, to the superintendent of public instruction, for how it's set up based on what the team, and you know what the teamwork is like. Things just sift to the top that you may or may not have expected to sift to the top. So the flexibility in subsection 6 will account for just that. Thank you.
Representative Merkley, thank you. Madam Speaker, I have several questions. One in terms of the structure of the committee itself. I understand that the 14 positions provided for under Section 8, three are taken up by pre-established assignments, leaving 11 slots. In these 11 slots, there's 8 categories. People can fill the public, parents, boards, administrators, teachers, students, presidents, and administrators.
which means for most of those categories, there'd be a single, one single assignment. And in fact, the way it's structured, there's no guarantee that there would be a single teacher, no guarantee there'd be a single parent or a single student, because all these slots are assigned by the people who serve them. How do we make sure that we have adequate representation under this structure from those various components of teachers, administrators, parents, board members?
Thank you for the question. Chair Welch, Representative Berkeley, if you have some suggestions of how that would make could be accounted for, I'd be happy to welcome those suggestions. Let me tell you that I made some assumptions with that. There's actually 11, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's actually 11 board members at large, if you will, with no assignments. And we've got parents, teachers, school members, school administrators, college presidents, and administrators as the components to make up those 11. So there's the potential of at least two per if we wanted to itemize that. We don't know for sure who the senator is going to be or who the representative is going to be. If it was Representative Piercy, she has taught before. So we'd get a teacher and a representative at the same time with her hat. So are you saying perhaps that we should look at the resumes of the legislators themselves or the community college commissioner, his resume, and then fill in the gaps? We could certainly do that. But I did make some assumptions that the two positions that the speaker would get to fill could be in coordination with the three that the governor is going to fulfill. I think that's one of the goals would be to talk to the other appointers, if you will, and see who they have filled the slot is, their slots with. Perhaps one of the recommendations would be that we would submit names and that the superintendent of public instruction could choose from those names to make sure that each one of those areas is fulfilled. I'm very flexible with that. I wanted to make sure that all people were at the table. I think personally that we can take care of it on our own. I could talk to Governor Kitzhaber and say, I made a couple of recommendations and they filled the parent and the teacher role. Could you make sure that you do one also, or could you include a private college president? There's some give and take in order for that to happen. But I would welcome your recommendations. Again, I appreciate Representative Welch not bringing this out today so that we could address some of those fine details.
I wanted to ask about the concept of accountability.
Uh-huh.
I think it's become a very popular term in this measure. And while we talk about accountability, the broader the concept has become, we have a fair amount of accountability in the current system that we sometimes forget about. Certainly I've seen this in my own local school boards, two school districts that I represent. We have school administrators who are evaluating their performance of their teachers. We have the school board members who are evaluating the administrators. We have the parents who are evaluating the school board members in the form of election. And one of my school districts, Parkland School District, has had a very fierce debate on the meaning of accountability. And
they haven't been in the news lately, though, I believe.
Been a little bit of a recess on it. But a very intense local discussion about this very concept of accountability. And that's kind of the process accountability. Then within the financial accountability, there's a whole, normally every school district has a book on accounting procedures, but some of the crude elements include the third-party audits, competitive bidding, and so forth. And then we have performance accountability in the forms of testing that occurs at various grades of various tests so we know where students are getting to. We've had lots of little questions about how we can improve process accountability, financial accountability, and performance accountability. Certainly, some of our challenges over implementing the Conference 21st Century is related, many of the points related to performance accountability. I am now looking at the list of things in Section 3 under the concept of accountability, and what I feel I'm seeing is essentially a list of evaluating every component of education. I'm not sure that we've missed anything. Everything from class size to textbooks to testing to maintaining buildings. How we do auditing, and it's very comprehensive. Essentially what it boils down to me is to evaluate every aspect of the way we do education. And I want to make sure that I understand that that is indeed the mission, not just beneath this accountability title.
Okay, Murphy, thank you for asking that question and for your thoughtfulness in the accountability piece. I want to go to the very beginning of Section 3. The leadership team shall make recommendations that address the environment that impacts student learning. They're going to address the environment to include conduct, advancement, safety, participation in learning, to the state board, to the state board of higher education, and other governmental entities. So again, going back to the broad perspective. And subsection 1, a definition of accountability. I started my comments by telling you that as soon as I say the word accountability, each one of you immediately conjures up something in your head of what accountability is, or is defined by, or how it's measured. A definition of accountability is one of the things that this board will be responsible for within the educational process and Oregon school system, including, but it's not limited to, fiscal, administrative, and structural responsibilities. Then a definition of accountability, that includes but is not limited to the following areas. And we may define that reading, and it could be very simple, the first day, again, I'm brainstorming as hypothetical, but it could be determined that reading accountability is defined as test scores. I don't personally believe that that is the only way to define accountability in reading as test scores. Maybe accountability is how many new textbooks there are as another way to measure accountability in reading. Maybe it's how many professors have actually been in the classroom teaching methods to third graders as a way to define accountability. But we can make those determinations, and we can then prioritize. Perhaps the prioritization in attainment of teacher's licensure, that would be J. Perhaps the determination for that particular accountability would be for this legislative team, the education team, to assign that responsibility to TSPC. Not specifically for the way that things are done now, but make the suggestion to TSPC that they come up with a way to measure or a way to hold teachers accountable for national testing or national licensure. I'm not sure. Again, I'm brainstorming here. But each one of these components can either be kept within or can be delegated out. But again, it's all the leaders at the table, all the decision makers at the table. When I say all the decision makers at the table, I mean parents. I mean teachers. I mean those people that have a vested interest in what education is all about in our state. So again, thank you very much for that in-depth question.
Mr. Chair, an additional question. I think I take from that indeed the opportunity is opened by having these leaders together to really rethink whatever piece of our system they would like to rethink. And out of that could come concepts of best practices, or out of that could come a sense of expectations. And the federal government often translates expectations into, we only give you money if you do X, Y, and Z. And I imagine if I was a school board member, I might be worried the state is going to say that we implement these, our concept of what best practices are, or maybe something to the state. And I note in section 3, subparagraph 6, on page 3 of the bill, those administrative actions that should be implemented, and it gives a list including school district boards, and to improve accountability, but we've defined accountability as very broad. Is it your concept more that we would come out of this with a set of ideas for school boards to consider, or really a set of administrative actions we would expect school boards to implement regarding all these things, such as textbooks, teacher training, school maintenance, whole campus? More of an advisory or more of a directive to the local school districts?
Chair Welsh, Representative Merkley, the way that this committee is set up, the way the team is set up, it is advisory. But it's advisory in that because people are going to be at the table to have buy-in, they'll be able to then to have a bigger impact on wherever the recommendation is going. The recommendation may be going to the legislature, or the recommendation may be going to the state board, or it may be going to the Department of Ed or to the community college. But they will be recommendations in and of themselves. But I believe that they'll have more credibility as recommendations because there has been so much buy-in by a larger group of decision-makers. If we haven't done a good enough job as an education leadership team to get the buy-in or the input from school boards, then I would expect that the school boards would reject the idea, so it would be incumbent upon us to make sure that that happens. I can think of a couple of task forces that the governor has had in the past, and I'm not being critical of the governor, but when you exclude the legislature from a task force, it's a little bit harder to get the buy-in from the legislature on great ideas. And that's exactly why this committee is put up and the components are put are before us the way that they are, so that nobody is left out of the potential buy-in aspect of it. Again, this has never been done before. I don't know why. This makes so much sense to me. Why don't we sit down at the table and all talk about our kids? This is so simple. It makes no sense to me why it hasn't been done before.
Okay, then we need to move on with our other individuals wanting to give testimony.
I think one macro issue for us is the question of the degree to which the state is going to become a super school board, I guess is the term of art. And one of my surprises in this session has been the readiness of this body to provide legislation that directs school boards and how to run their school districts. I really came to the legislature with the philosophy that those decisions were best made by local school boards, that perhaps not perfect decisions, and some school boards do a better and worse job, but that there's strict accountability to the community in which they are, and that is appropriate and empowering. And my concern, especially more so because of the number of legislative directives we've passed through the House this session, is that when we come out with a list of good ideas that we as a state have said are now good ideas, but the very next step will be whether it's school uniforms or buy X number of textbooks will be to say do it this way. And I think on the financial accountability part, Is it your concept more that we would come out of this with a set of ideas for school boards to consider, or really a set of administrative actions we would expect school boards to implement regarding all these things, such as textbooks, teacher training, school maintenance, the whole gambit? More of an advisory or more of a directive to the local school districts?
Chair Welsh, Representative Merkley, the way that this committee is set up, the way the team is set up, it is advisory. But it's advisory in that because people are going to be at the table to have buy-in, they'll be able to then to have a bigger impact on wherever the recommendation is going. The recommendation may be going to the legislature, or the recommendation may be going to the state board, or it may be going to the Department of Ed or to the community college. But they will be recommendations in and of themselves. But I believe that they'll have more credibility as recommendations because there has been so much buy-in by a larger group of decision makers. If we haven't done a good enough job as an education leadership team to get the buy-in or the input from school boards, then I would expect that the school boards would reject the idea, so it'll be incumbent upon us to make sure that that happens. I can think of a couple of task forces that the governor has had in the past, and I'm not being critical of the governor, but when you exclude the legislature from a task force, it's a little bit harder to get the buy-in from the legislature on great ideas. And that's exactly why this committee is put up and the components are put for us the way that they are, so that nobody is left out of the potential buy-in aspect of it. Again, this has never been done before. I don't know why. This makes so much sense to me. Why don't we sit down at the table and all talk about our kids? This is so simple. It makes no sense to me why it hasn't been done before.
Okay, then we need to move on with our other individuals wanting to give testimony.
I think one macro issue for us is the question of the degree to which the state is going to become a super school board, I guess it's a term of art. And one of my surprises in this session has been the readiness of this body to provide legislation that directs school boards and how to run their school districts. I really came to the legislature with the philosophy that those decisions were best made by local school boards, that perhaps not perfect decisions, and some school boards do a better and worse job, but that the strict accountability to the community in which they are, and that is appropriate and empowering. And my concern, especially more so because of the number of legislative directives we've passed through the House this session, is that when we come out with a list of good ideas that we as a state have said are now good ideas, that the very next step will be whether it's school uniforms or buy X number of textbooks will be to say do it this way. And I think on the financial accountability part of the concern over school districts has been when they lay out all their financial decisions and everyone can access those from the web, that the next step will be to say, well, you made the wrong decision. I don't know what your personal philosophy is about this, and I guess my question is, do you think we need to move in the direction of giving a lot more legislative direction to school boards? And if not, how do we avoid that when we undertake a process like this?
Chair Wells, Representative Merkley, we are where we are by virtue of two huge dynamic changes. Measure 5, the financial aspect, and education reform, education reform passed by a legislative body years ago. We're at the point right now where they're intersecting. That's what's happening. Whether we like it or not, the legislature is more involved in education today than they were when you and I were in school, for sure when I was in school.
Not that much difference.
He says there's a lot of difference. I read the numbers. Whether we like it or not, the legislature is more involved, and we need to face that as a reality and as a fact, and then now we need to make sure that we are speaking in a forward motion with the same goals in mind. We either need to change how we finance schools, which I don't think we're going to be able to do, or we need to change education reform as the legislature. And when I say that, I mean as the legislature passed it. Never in history had the legislature passed that kind of mandate on school districts. They passed the mandate. This legislative body passed the mandate, except this one, myself. The small stuff that we're doing this session is nothing compared to what that legislation was in 91. Right? We need to face the fact that the legislature is more responsible today for those kinds of decisions than ever in the past. Now, if we want to completely eliminate us from that role, then we need to do some major changes. And how we, if we want local control, totally local control, then we have to get rid of those two huge components, how we fund and education reform. I'm not suggesting that we do that. What I'm suggesting is that we face reality of where we are right now. And how best can we make it so that the locals do have a say in how they fund their schools, how they spend their money in their schools, or how they accept the high standards or not. And having all of those decision makers at the table with that much buying can only be helpful to the locals, not his representative, Chair Wells. I know we have other people here. I'm just going to have a couple of closing comments, if you might. If I might, Project Success is what I've named this. And the reason I've done this is because I do want to focus on their success. This is not a blame game. This is not a finger pointing. This is about success. This is about an outcome that we want and that we desire for our kids and for our state. I'm going to tell you what Project Success is not. It is not an agenda to get rid of education reform, but it's an examination of all the factors around education equation. And education reform is one of those components, but it's not about getting rid of it. It's not an attempt to usurp local control, but it is a recognition of the greater roles in Oregon's new era of school financing. It's a new era that's not brought on by me personally, but by the voters who shifted the financing paradigm by supporting measures 5 and 47 and 50. It's not a duplication of past efforts, but a comprehensive, coordinated approach in making connections between these pieces. And it's not a mechanism to assess blame or fault, but an opportunity to establish goals. Goals with clear and objective accountability standards so that high standards can be achieved. Project Success, this is what it is. It's a monumental effort. In fact, very simple if you think about it, but monumental effort to address the many challenges facing our education system from kindergarten through the graduate level. Project Success is a leadership forum to make recommendations about accountability standards and to establish clear and objective goals easily understood by Oregonians. And it's a chance to finally define in the most understandable terms what taxpayers and students alike have a right to expect from our education system by establishing goals so high standards can be achieved. That's my vision for success in our educational system. Chair Wesh, thank you so much for your abundance of time this morning in committee. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandra. I appreciate that. On our list next would be Jack Roberts, Commissioner of Labor and Industry. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name for the record is Jack Roberts. I'm the Commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here to speak in behalf of House Bill 3633. I'll keep this brief to make a couple of points. First, I want to make it clear that the passage of this bill to this committee is in no way a substitute for fairly and adequately funding education this biennium. And by education, I mean not just K-12, but community colleges and higher education. And it's my understanding, at least it's been explained to me, that is not the intent of this bill, and no one should point to this bill as in any way a way of avoiding the responsibility that you have, and that I know you're grappling with, of making sure that you adequately fund education. Secondly, I agree with the speaker that the strength of this committee and what makes it different than most other work groups, task force, and committees that have been formed is the fact that it attempts to bring both elected and appointed policymakers to the table to help outline and to understand a strategy for education in a comprehensive way. Speaking at least from the standpoint of the elected officials, I think the real strength of this is not so much what those individuals bring to the table as what they take from it. And I think having the opportunity to have this discussion and understanding, to share common information and to roll up their sleeves and deal with the details of what is already going on and understand how, in many cases, it already fits into a comprehensive system, and then to look for ways to make that work better, brings an opportunity for those people to leave that meeting with some understanding, some buy-in, and some commitment to follow through with what's happened. Too often in the past, task force come to the legislature and report on what they've determined, whether it's a group of experts that get together or a group of citizens or a group of interest groups. But the fact is, the elected officials often have no real buy-in or ownership, and in many cases it can become then a basis for partisan and other wrangling and disputes over who gets the credit, who gets the blame, and who gets stuck with the responsibility. I think this has the opportunity to be different than that. And the third point that I'd make is that I appreciate the fact that there's an attempt here to look at education in its broadest, most comprehensive sense. In that regard, I'm particularly grateful to the speaker of including the Bureau of Labor and Industries because of our responsibility in the apprenticeship area. We have responsibility for overseeing apprenticeship programs. Statutorily, as the Labor Commissioner, I chair the Oregon Apprenticeship and Training Council. I think too often we overlook the fact that when people leave high school, and I happen to believe these days everybody needs some post-secondary education, but it doesn't mean everyone has to go to a four-year college or a two-year community college. There are other ways of training and education, and apprenticeship is one of the real secrets that we have for too long kept hidden as to how a lot of people receive not just on-the-job training, but actual education, classroom education, for a lifetime that allows them to support their family and advance their trade. And so I appreciate very much her decision to include us in that. And I think that sort of view of a broader range of education will help us during the interim to focus on what we need to do as a state, even though I think that the challenges that we face today are going to require this and more.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much for being here today. Next would be Sal Cox.
For the record, my name is Al Cox. I'm an educator. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I am a pre- and a post-STEM teacher, and in identifying myself in that regard, I can give you a short, fuzzy history of what classroom teachers have been faced with from the state, as I recall, and this may not be fully accurate for those of you who are well steeped in that history. But when I started in 1980, I came out of the teacher preparation program and arrived at Lincoln Junior High School, which was one more year of junior high school, 7, 8, 9, and following that we moved to a middle school. And there were, I believe it was 182, it may have been 145, minimum competencies which the ninth graders were required to meet. I had never heard of those. So my first year teaching, I was faced with, at some point during the year, we needed to check off whether we thought our students, all 185 of them that we saw in a day, had met these various minimum competencies for the ninth grade. That didn't last long. We became a middle school, and I don't believe the minimum competencies lasted much more than a year past that. As occasionally occurs now, I became an eighth grade teacher instead of a ninth grade teacher, and I didn't have to worry about it even if they did exist because they were at the ninth grade level. That has carried over a little bit to the current system, which I do want to address. Then there were, somewhere along the line, common curriculum goals, which the state set from the state board, that sat in a large notebook on my shelf that I looked at the beginning of the year and put away and then returned to the office at the end of the year during teacher checkout. That was very standard practice in many schools. I have an advantage of having taught in many different buildings, and so I'm not concentrating all my experience from one venue. Somewhere in there also I work for Lincoln County Schools, and their ninth grade proficiency, which is a writing proficiency that occurred before the statewide writing assessment. Now we have what was 3565 in 1991, and I didn't really, and I taught all the way through that, hear much about that. The Oregon Education Act for the 21st Century didn't reach my ears as a classroom teacher pretty much at all. The reform, however, which occurred in 1995, really did, because all of a sudden teachers were being held accountable to classroom not only performance standards, which were being reworked and issued, in a sense, from the Department of Education, but also the state testing, which was being implemented beginning then. The writing assessment had been occurring before then, but had not been particularly, were not particularly held accountable. It was sort of for us to know and for our students to know. Representative Taylor is right. Not one teacher cannot represent all the teachers' voices. I could certainly talk about colleagues who are very, very negative about what is happening now. I can talk about colleagues who started negative and are now actually on board, in a sense. If you wanted research on that, I know that David Conley of the University of Oregon has done a lot of Oregon research concerning teachers' feelings about the current reforms. And there are many. And anecdotally, I know have several colleagues and also friends who have moved from the very negative to the sort of middle of the road and some to the actual positive side. However, in thinking about what I think what is before you is about, I am a little interested in the possibility that there would be some group that would be tracking what is happening pre-K through 16, and I have a few reasons for that, but one of them is when I was involved in 1995, and I was somewhat involved with the 2991, it wasn't until then that I realized that as a teacher, I could actually pick up the phone and call the Department of Education and say, I'm a teacher in this very small school in Oregon, and I need some information, and they would be very happy to give me that information. I didn't know that. I've been teaching since 1980 in this state. But I also discovered that the legislature created a law, and the department then, with the legislature, and I guess the state board creates Oregon Administrative Rules, OARs, and from the OARs, then the school districts, usually through the superintendent, receive that information that is required by the state, and then the district, the superintendent, give that information out to their district. Now, that happens in many different ways. If you're a rural school district, your superintendent receives that information, they might walk down the hallway and hand it to the principal of the school. If you're a large district, that information may be handed to the curriculum and instruction department, and they will do with it what they want to do, and then it will be disseminated to the principal. Where it goes from the principal sort of depends. I've worked in buildings where information reached the principal and never reached the classroom teacher. I've also worked in buildings where information from the department was shoved in all the teachers' boxes. Now, I know a little bit about how the business world works, but we all have, I believe, what we call tertiary piles. If you're organized, it's in a box. If you're not, it's at the bottom of your desk. And you also have must-do, that's on top, and must-do tomorrow or the next day. And for teachers, of course, you have 194 students, or you have 30 students with 6 subject matters that you're trying to organize and teach. So you receive information that might actually be helpful, but it's not on top, because you need to make this phone call to this parent, you need to sign or attend this individual education plan meeting, you need to have these papers to grade, these tests to get back, and then you have another pile that's due 2 days from now. In a sense, we have due dates just like our students do. So information like good information that may come from the state or come from the Department of Ed gets thrown in a pile, and in June you pick it up and you think, well, I'll read it over the summer. And maybe you do. A lot of us do a lot of professional reading over the summer, except that you read it and you go, oh, they had a focus group in March in my district about what I'm doing, except I didn't know. And I found out about it in June or July, more likely. You have a few weeks to catch up with your family or whatever you might want to do before you sort of hit the books for the following fall. I do know that the Department of Education, and I have listened to them testify as well, has tried and has held focus groups across the state on the various things that often teachers get angry because they haven't had any input. Well, it wasn't because we weren't asked. It was because we were too busy. And the way we were asked might not have been effective or was really the only way to ask. I don't know. You can't certainly, anyone who works in a monolithic system like ours knows you can't pick up the phone and call every individual teacher in the state to invite them, or every, even if you're in a focus group, say, in Bend, every teacher in Bend, that would be a tremendous, I mean, it's just not practical. So how do you get that information out? So sometimes when you hear that the feedback from educators hasn't been at the bottom level, at the teaching on the front line tier, it's not because we weren't asked, it's because somehow we missed that information. And I'm certainly guilty of that, and I don't know if we're guilty or not. It's just part of the way a huge paradigm like this works. So if you take the fact that the, for instance, benchmarks and SIMS, there are two other points I'd like to make. One is there are two kinds of districts, and I have worked both in rural districts and in one large, somewhat suburban, but still quite large district. There seem to be two approaches to the particular initial mastery and its benchmarks for a third, fifth, and eighth. One is we're going to do what the state requires and no more because we're just trying to get our feet solid and we have don't have a lot of resources. We don't have a curriculum and instruction, either department, let alone a person or a professional development person, which several large districts have. We don't have that. So we will tell our teachers what's required and we'll work with that. And what's required is enough for a teacher to deal with. But then you also have these large districts who want their SIM somehow to stand out, and I'm maybe making a political statement here that I shouldn't, but I know that in one district I worked in, it was very important to that district that they have a really, like, a model SIM. So teachers ended up doing were required, and I know this because I was the building assessment coordinator for this building in this district, were required to do work samples, many work samples, I think four or five in every area. So that meant four or five in math, four or five in speaking, four or five in reading, four or five in literature, four or five in writing, all year long. Four or five in science, even though they had not implemented science at the time this was going on. And then every student in the building had a portfolio in which all those work samples were tracked. Teachers are required to assess based on the state rubric. Now you can imagine what happened. How do students understand the state rubric? So what did that do? Teachers were pulled out of class and asked to write a state level rubric. Now Beaverton had already done that for us and did not copyright it with the state writing, which was wonderful. So we had actually third and fifth grade level explanations about what all those rubrics meant that we could borrow from them. But we rewrote the reading, both the literature and the content, and they're two different pieces to read. We rewrote the math for 8th and 5th. I was in an unusual middle school that had 5th and 8th grade both, 5th through 8th. So you can imagine the amount of time that was poured into that. One year later, the Department of Education came out with much of this material. But we were on the fast track. We were in this district who wanted to say, look, we can do this, and this is really good. I'm talking out of turn here because I'm not exactly sure what you're looking at, but I know that you're looking at what might be a group of people who would take into consideration all of what it means to be pre-K through 16. I think when you consider the PATH program, I just finished at Titusville High School, and I think I was teaching their only foreign language, and for 2 months in pregnancy leave, very few students knew what PATH meant. I've also spent a lot of time this year at Willamette High School in Eugene. They all know what's happening. It's a huge dichotomy between the rural and sort of the more urban. I'm not sure if Eugene quite qualifies, but at least at Willamette High School, they knew about PATH, partly, I'm sure, because the University of Oregon is there. Titusville didn't have an idea, and I think communication and how it's seen and how information is disseminated may be one big piece to sort of de-threatening that is such a word, is taking away some of the concerns that not only parents but students have, and certainly teachers who are in the middle of all this. That would be something I think maybe this group could address. One last point is, the other thing I'd like to see it address is the question of what do we do about students who are already there? I taught a Spanish 1 class that was parallel to high school Spanish 1, but we weren't allowed to give our students credit, even though they passed the Spanish 1 final exam from the high school at the 8th grade level and went on into Spanish 2. And I understand the reality. The reality is you give them credit, and there's a whole other class that student can take at the high school level, and the high school may not have those things to provide. And I just found out that indeed that high school is taking some of my students who were taking Spanish 1 in 8th grade, who are now in what they, because Spanish in that school is 1-2 for the first two semesters. So they are 9-10, but there is no Spanish 9-10. And I just found out from the principal of the high school that they're trying to accommodate those students. Not sending them off to Manhood Community College, which happens to be the venue where they are. This seamlessness, I think, is another issue that certainly deserves looking at. Thank you. If there are any questions, I suppose.
Ms. Cox, thank you very much. Is there a question for the committee? Mr. McLean, Merkley.
We have a sense that this committee has a very broad charge and could focus on what it chooses. What do you think is the most important thing for this committee to focus on during the interim?
You're talking about the committee book that you're considering?
Yes.
I think they should focus on communication of the purpose of the, probably the sin of the final outcome. We're not dealing with CAM or PASS, because students aren't certain why they need to do this. Parents aren't sure. I have good answers for that, but until there's a real weight behind it, I think that's probably one of the most important first things to look at. The second would be, what is the buy-in and why? How has the communication process happened in terms of, you know, why do we have people feeling like they didn't have input? You're going to have as many ideas as you have people, certainly, when you're dealing with this. But I think putting some understanding, I wouldn't say teeth, because the teeth are already there, certainly for me as classroom owner. And at the risk of sounding perhaps, I don't know, I would also suggest you have post-SIM teachers when you're talking about what teachers to have. There is a major difference between teachers who ceased teaching or were teachers before having to deal with benchmarks and teachers who have had to cope with that part of the system.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your input.
Next, the Joe Cox.
Several of the issues with the these are simply safety remarks and put them into one page to Facebook form and deliver them to you later today, trying to summarize our 4 years working on the council. I do like to say that I commend your interest in...
Joe, go ahead and sit down.
Well,
sit down and give us...
Well, I mind the time. I do appreciate your looking at the broader K-16 perspective. The more we can move away, if you'll forgive a metaphor, from looking at individual scatter rugs to looking at a tapestry and how it all fits together, I think that advantages all of us. Superintendent Bunn and I are very much committed to working together to try to move us all in that direction. As I said, we've spent 4 years in this vineyard. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've learned a lot, and I'll try to summarize that in the form for you today. Basically, what I would say is that it takes time. You have to change the culture at all the levels, and you've got to have absolute buy-in from the bottom up, back to Mr. McTaylor's point. You can't just impose. You've got to have buy-in. It's got to be as broad as it possibly can be, and it has to avoid being judgmental. You have to be aimed at how do we improve the outcome that we all support, rather than judgments which are easy to render. So we're if the legislature moves in this direction, we are prepared to bring the 4 years of work that we have done, if that's useful, and to join in the effort. And I'll try to summarize some of those experiences in a little more detail for you and have it delivered to your office today.
I appreciate that. We will have more opportunity for testimony. I have some others on my list that we won't get to today, but we'll have this scheduled again for Thursday of this week, and we'll have testimony, and I'll bring those up first. And Joe, if you have anything further on Thursday,
okay,
just let us know.
We'll be sure I get to see you today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay. I apologize, we did not get to the full list, but we will, as I said, continue on Thursday. Okay?
Mr. Chair, will we be hearing from the superintendent of execution?
Very possibly on Thursday. I don't know at this point in time whether or not he wants to give testimony, but he's certainly welcome to do that.
I would certainly welcome it since he's the chair of the
We have COSA, OEA, and OSCA for testimony on Thursday to start with. Okay?
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'll wrap things up.
About what teachers to have. There is a major difference between teachers who ceased teaching or were teachers before having to deal with benchmarks and teachers who have had to cope with that part of the system.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your input. Next would be Joe Cox.
These are simply safety remarks. I put them into one page to paper this morning. I'll deliver them to you later today. If I can summarize our 4 years working on accountability. I do would like to say that I commend your interest in...
Joe, go ahead and sit down.
Well,
sit down and give us...
Well, I might have missed time.
We'll be all right.
I do appreciate your looking at the broader K-16 perspective. The more we can move away, if you'll forgive a metaphor, from looking at individual scatter rugs to looking at a tapestry and how it all fits together, I think that advantages all of us. Superintendent Bunn and I are very much committed to working together to try to move us all in that direction. As I said, we've spent 4 years in this vineyard. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've learned a lot, and I'll try to summarize that in written form for you today. Basically, what I would say is that it takes time. You have to change the culture at all the levels, and you've got to have absolute buy-in from the bottom up, back to Representative Taylor's point. You can't just impose. You've got to have buy-in. It's got to be as broad as it possibly can be, and it has to avoid being judgmental. You have to be aimed at what? How do we improve the outcome that we all support, rather than judgments which are easy to render. So we're if the legislature moves in this direction, we're prepared to bring the 4 years of work that we have done, if that's useful, and to join in the effort. And I'll try to summarize some of those experiences in a little more detail for you and have it delivered to your offices today.
I appreciate that. We will have more opportunity for testimony. I have some others on my list that we won't get to today, but we'll have this scheduled again for Thursday of this week, and we'll have testimony, and I'll bring those up first. And Joe, if you have anything further on Thursday, just let us know.
We'll be sure I get to see you today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks
for talking. Okay. I apologize, we did not get to the full list, but we will, as I said, continue on Thursday.
Okay? Mr. Chair, will we be hearing from the superintendent of execution?
Very possibly on Thursday. I don't know at this point in time whether or not he wants to give testimony, but he's certainly welcome to do that.
I would certainly welcome it since he's the chair of the
We have COSA, OEA, and OSDA do testimony on Thursday to start with.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to echo that request because I feel that the agenda is broad enough that really what this committee becomes will be in the face of the vision of the chair, and I'd certainly like to hear his vision for where I'd like to take this.
Very good. I think we've had some good comments and good questions from the committee also. And it'll be important to what we end up with on Thursday.
And if there are possible recommendations, too, that would probably be best filled out in proposed amendments, that's certainly something that we'd probably take a look at also here. And I know I haven't talked to the sponsor of the bill on that particular issue, but you know that that is part of our process here. And those recommendations sometimes are best filled out. And we'll have the committee entertain those.
Okay.
Thanks very much. We'll close our hearing on House Bill 3633 for the day. And have no further business. We'll adjourn for the day.